Hi, this is Tiffany Bova. Welcome to this episode of What's Next podcast, where I have the pleasure of welcoming Jeremy Utley to the show. He is the Director of Executive Education at Stanford's D School and an adjunct professor at Stanford School of Engineering. He is also the co-host of the D School's widely popular program, Stanford's Masters of Creativity. He's the co-author of Idea Flow, the only business metric that matters. And I'm super excited to have him here today. Unfortunately, we had a little bit of a tech difficulty, so we had to cut out bullish and bearish. But I hope you enjoy the rest of the show.
Yeah, I know. It's like, well, now it better be better, right? That's take two. But very simply, we believe creativity is a deeply human capacity. Everyone has the capacity to be creative. But sadly, that capacity has lied dormant for many people because perhaps when they're in second grade or third grade, somebody told them that picture didn't look like a rhinoceros or whatever, right? And so you go, oh, I'm not creative. And they kind of go inward. But that's not true. The truth is everyone has the capacity to be creative. And it's maybe undeveloped. It may not be nurtured. It may have atrophied. But if you ask a room full of kindergartners who's creative, everybody raises their hand, right? At least in the U.S., it's something like third grade. When you ask a third grade classroom, all of a sudden there starts to be a drop off there. Now, what happened to them? Are they genetically different? No, it's a matter of nurture, not nature. And so, for us, what we say is we exist at the Stanford D School to cultivate the creative confidence of students at Stanford and the world more broadly. And for students at Stanford, especially, we're talking engineers and MBAs and lawyers and doctors. And what they believe is I'm analytical. I'm not creative, right? And we fundamentally don't buy that. Now, our institutions and our systems and our incentives tend to reward a particular way of thinking. It's critical thinking, okay? And very simply, one of my favorite pieces of research, which kind of helped sheds a little bit of light on this, Dr. Charles Lim is a neurologist at Johns Hopkins University. And what Dr. Lim was interested in discovering is what happens when someone enters a creative mode. So, for example, a jazz musician, they're playing kind of known chords. That's not necessarily creative. But then when they enter improv, that is a kind of a creative moment. Or a hip hop artist, right? To recite a few bars of a Jay-Z song isn't creative. But to freestyle and to flow your own rhyme, that's creative, right? So, of course, Dr. Lim, being a neurologist, you know what he did? He put freestyle hip hop artists and jazz musicians inside of fMRI scanners. And he said, okay, what part of the brain lights up whenever someone shifts from kind of known chords or known bars into freestyle? It's not particularly helpful to say the creative part of the brain lights up, right? So what's fascinating actually is what part of the brain went dark? Do you know what it was?
The analytical brain.
It's the critical brain. The judgmental brain. They literally, the creative individuals literally turned off judgment. And it's interesting, right? Because if you think about what so much of our career, certainly education, but also career is cultivating is deeper critical thinking, deeper ability to judge, analyze, evaluate, et cetera. And yet it turns out the creative impulse is actually fundamentally about turning that off. And if you think about that as kind of a muscle that's got to be flexed, like almost like a light switch, we got a lot of practice turning it on. We have very little practice turning it off. And so when you say, how do we cultivate creativity? Or how do we practice creativity? Well, practice turning it off. Turn off judgment. Turn off criticism. You know, write down a bad idea. You want a very simple activity? Write down a bad idea. And I'm a recovering MBA. You know, I love spreadsheets. I love pivot tables. And if you get me to write down a bad idea, I have a hard time. You know why? Because it's a waste of paper. And I'm just going to throw it away anyway. It's like not efficient. It's not effective. I have 1,000 reasons. By the way, I've wasted more cognitive brain power explaining why I shouldn't do it than just in doing it. And yet, we don't. And so when you want to cultivate the creative impulse, it's basically practicing something different. And you can do that every single day. It's just generate alternatives. I mean, one of my favorite definitions of creativity is a seventh grader in Ohio. She says this, creativity is doing more than the first thing you think of. I love that. It's better than Arthur Kessler, the Hungarian philosopher. Doing more than the first thing you think of. And you can do that for an email subject line, right? You want to be creative in your email? just think of another title, or for this podcast, right? You're going to title this podcast. Why would you not come up with 10 titles? That's fundamentally the creative act. You're deferring judgment. You're practicing turning that switch off. And our belief is, and what we've observed over, you know, thousands of students, tens of thousands, I've taught millions now, if they turn it off, they actually grow in their confidence, and they grow in their competence to imagine and to create novel connections.
First of all, that was great, because I think those two hacks, right? Although I don't like that term always, right? Write down bad ideas and do more than the first thing you think of, right? Those two things I think are brilliant. Some of the judgment is not just self-judgment, right? Like, so as you said, like some of it is the teacher who said that doesn't look like a rhinoceros at all, right? And so you've got no psychological safety in I don't want to be judged. So I'm not going to toss out a bad idea. So I overanalyze. And when you asked what part of the brain, and I said analytical, it was really critical thinking, right? That whole like, well, hold on, let me think. It has to be perfect. And in my mind, I'm going to go through the 10 bad ideas. And in my mind, I'm going to go through the 10 things. Right. That's, and then I'm going to say the 11th. It doesn't work that way.
No, you just keep, I mean, it's called the Einstelling effect, right? It's a well-established cognitive bias since 1942. Abraham and Edith Lutyens identified the fact that when you're trying to solve a problem that has some kind of superficial, similarities to other problems, even when you're told there's a better solution, your brain keeps going back to the first solution you thought of. And it's maybe has to do with Herbert Simon's idea of satisficing, perhaps, but basically we are lazy. And even when we say we're looking, if we think we already know the answer, we're not looking. And here's a problem. Very few of the challenges we're facing are math problems with one quote unquote right answer. You know, the challenge of titling this podcast, there's a billion possible, right? Better, worse, in different answers. The likelihood, I mean, there is basically zero empirical evidence to suggest that an earlier idea is a better idea. There's basically none. And you know, it's fascinating. I'll tell you something kind of cool. I've built a software tool called Try10, which enables kind of learners to just like try on almost like an ophthalmologist, better one, better two, just try on a bunch of different lenses, so to speak. I've had students using this at Stanford. Thousands of students have used it. And it just pushes people to come up with 10 alternatives. Do you know the percent to any problem? Do you know the percentage of students who say their first idea is their favorite?
Oh, it's probably in the 80s or 90s.
3.1%.
Oh, really? Think their first one?
Yes. You know why? Because they realize that another idea is every bit as much of a likelihood as to be good, right? And you know what's wild? More than double that number, it's something like 6.5%, say after the 10th idea is the best idea, right? That's amazing, right? But the point is, our assumption is exactly what you said. It's probably like 80% of likelihood that my best idea is the first thing I think of. But the actual reality, the experience reality is, wow, if I generate more than one, it's hardly ever the case that the first idea is the best idea. And yet the default is we think of one answer, we move on.
Well, the reason I said that number was because you had just said there was sort of that bias of
But that's what your answer was about expectations. And I agree. Okay. Someone's expectation is 80% of the time my first idea is best.
Okay, got it.
The experience reality, I haven't asked about expectations, I've asked about reality. And the reality is very, very exceptionally small percentage of the time is their first idea the best. The other question that would be great to ask, which I haven't asked, but I should, is how many times do you push for more than one answer? And right there, the number is probably very, it's probably only when their, you know, nutty professor assigns them to do it once a day. That's probably it.
Well, I often start all my keynotes with a quote that in the expert's mind, there are very few possibilities. In the beginner's mind, there are many, right? And unfortunately, lots of us have the expert's mind, right? I know the answer. I'm going to apply the same context, the same lens, and I'm going to solve the problem with the same set of information versus saying, hold on, let me challenge my assumptions. Let me go look at context. Let me have that beginner's mind, kind of the fixed and growth mindset. But it's more about that beginner's mind of, I have to not be fixed on, this is always the way I solve it. I talk to these three people and I write it on, you know what I mean? Like, that's the way I do it versus let me get super uncomfortable and let me come up with 10. let me, you know, ask the question, how many times did I ask the question, right? And that is a behavior that isn't necessarily, that muscle is very weak.
It's not exactly, and that's the thing. The wrong conclusion to draw is, therefore, people are incapable. That's not true. The right conclusion to draw is, wow, I need to build a new muscle. And that's where people make the mistake. They go, oh, there's just some people who's just, gosh, lightning just always strikes their house. No, they're practiced. They have experience seeing, wow, if I just like let myself think about this a little bit more, if I just ask, what else could I try? I end up with better stuff, right? That's why we say it's innovation is not an event. You know, all these workshops and, you know, hackathons and sprints, I'm all about a workshop. That's fine. I mean, I run workshops at Stanford all the time. Sprints are fine. But it's fundamentally about a capability, developing a capability. The sprint is useful if you've done weight training and stretching and practice. Most sprints in organizations result in pulled hamstrings, not trophies. And they result in pulled hamstrings because people are getting out on the track in jumpsuits with like Cheeto stains on them. They haven't stretched. They haven't practiced. And you say, ready, sprint? It's like, if you asked me to sprint up the hill outside my house right now, I couldn't do that. Why? I'm not warm. I've been sitting here for 2 hours, right? And yet we do the same thing cognitively when we get everybody in the conference room. It's like, dude, when's the last time the gathering in the conference room resulted in magic?
Well, and I think that goes back to, I remember when Blue Ocean Strategy first came out, and I love the book, and I like the follow-up because I think it contained a lot of things that I felt was dangerous in the first book. And I use that word on purpose, right? Where if you don't have an innovative culture and you don't have an innovative mindset and you haven't been practicing like going after blue ocean, you approach it with a red ocean mindset. And right. So the company doesn't even have the muscle. Let's go back to what we were talking about, right? On how to create ideas, how to innovate, like that they don't have, and the culture isn't set up for failure. They don't know how to reward failure. And the only way to sort of get to the magic is you got to go through a little bit of failure. It could be the 9th try or the 10th try or the 10th idea or the 20th idea. Right, right. But if you're not safe and rewarded for the journey, right, then you're like, it has to be right. So you think that brainstorming sprint hackathon is going to produce, you know, beauty. And even in a design thinking workshop, right, it's not going to be the first time. It is that iterative process. And if organizations, and if you're listening to this, right, and your manager doesn't do this in a meeting where it's always, you got to come up with this one answer, you know, what would you advise people who are listening to this that want to sort of start to adopt this and exercise this muscle, yet their environment, where they're working, who they work for, their team, whatever, is not set up for this kind of idea flow?
Yeah, I think I would say manage down, not up. So there are two ways you can take, you know, for example, my friend Astro Teller, who's the head of Google X, has a saying, give me five. Anytime somebody has an idea, he wants to hear five. And he says, I said, well, what's the impact of that? He goes, well, most teams know that I'm going to ask for five. And so they bring their favorite idea and then four dummy ideas. But half the time, one of their dummy ideas is actually better than their favorite idea, you know? And so somebody hears that, they can respond to, when I say manage up or manage down, they can respond in one of two ways. They can say, I wish Astro was my boss. That's managing up. Man, I should send my boss this podcast, right? That's managing up. Don't do that. The other way to do it is to say, I want to be Astro. I want to ask my team to give me five. I want within my span of control, I'm going to affect a different, that's managing downward. Don't try to get your boss to be Astro Teller. You be Astro Teller. Not in like the resource that you may not be able to deploy tens of millions of dollars of capital. That's fine. But with the marketing campaign, can you say, give me five? With the reimbursement process, can you say, give me five? Can you, right? And all of a sudden, that is, you can start to unleash people underneath you, even if you feel you're, you know, leashed yourself.
Well, what if you're an individual contributor? Could you ask yourself that? Like, okay, I'm getting ready to present up, right? Yes. So I have to present the marketing campaign for the new product launch, and I need to come forward with the idea, right? Yeah. The one idea. Here's what we're going to do. Should I take it upon myself to say, I brainstormed, I came up with these three, and it might be the starting point for a some kind of mashup of two of them, right? Yeah. Or all three of them, or none of them, you know? But if you're an individual contributor and you can't manage down, you only can manage your own sphere bubble.
Right, absolutely. And here's something that's fun. If you want to think out of the box, get out of the box. If you want different outputs to your thinking, consider what are the inputs to your thinking. One of the maestro abilities that Steve Jobs had was he knew he had to get out of the building. You know, you go all the way back to the first Macintosh. He's frustrated by the design. You know what he does? He gets in his car and he drives to Stanford Shopping Center and he goes to Macy's. You know why? He doesn't know what he's looking for, but he knows he needs something new in his mind. And he's going up and down the aisles and he sees a Cuisinart food mixer, food processor. And he buys it and he brings it back to the design team and he says, it should look like this. Now, if you're a computer designer in the early days of the PC revolution, what in the world does a Cuisinart food processor have to do with anything, right? And yet if you're us looking back on the Macintosh development, you go, oh, I can see that, right? And the point is, not again, it's this instinct to get out. And I think for a lot of individual contributors, I'm chained to my desk. It's only what's in my head or on my computer that matters. There's no permission to get new input. And our imaginations are triggered by unexpected input. So we have to develop this intuition and this muscle memory around when I got to solve a problem, the prime directive is to seek new information, right? I want to build trust with our customers. How do we build trust? Stop everything and say, who's spectacular at building trust? Is it the tattoo parlor down the street? I'm going to go and watch. How do they build trust? Is it the kindergarten school pickup? I'm going to go watch. Is it a midwife or doula? Is it a barber, right? If you realize the world is filled with inspiration, you know, Sister Carita Kent, this amazing nun who was an art teacher at a School of Immaculate Heart. She wrote a great book called Learning by Heart. And she used to teach her students, I wish I usually keep one on my desk, I can't find it. She would have them take what she called a finder out into the world. And it's just a cardboard cutout. And she would say, go out into the world and look through your finder. And what anyone can do, no one can keep you from doing this. Go out into the world with your finder. You know, you want to know what a finder is? Okay, here, I'm just going to make one right now. This is like, people won't be able to see this, but you will. You can take a piece of paper, just like I'm doing right now. You can just fold it in half, tear it down the middle, tear one side out, and then tear the other side out. And voila. There's your finder, right? And all you do is you go into the world and you say, how would the kindergarten teacher solve that problem? How would the tattoo artist approach this trust building challenge? If I go to my barber, how does she respond when I say, I want to look like Brad Pitt? You know, what my barber said is, no matter what I do with your hair, you're not going to look like Brad Pitt, right? Okay. Oh, brutal honesty. How does that build trust, right? And on and on and on. The point is, when you think about seeking input to inspire your thinking, this is something designers do. My wife's a fashion designer. She's got this thing for Paris. I swear it's just a boondoggle for macarons, right? But she actually comes back from Paris inspired by textures and colors and shapes, and it's fresh. You know, for me as an MBA, I go, if it doesn't fit into a spreadsheet, then it has no business in my thinking. And I don't know how to put inspiration into the spreadsheet. Yet what I know is being deliberate about seeking fresh input drives fresh output. In many cases, what we seek in business is we seek fresh output, but we're unwilling to seek fresh input.
Oh, well said. Well said. Well, Jeremy, this has been fantastic. I have enjoyed it. I've taken a bunch of notes. So I am going to re-listen to this podcast and then I will reread the book with a different eye. You know, sometimes when you read a book, you're sort of like, I am a visual learner. I'm a listen learner, not necessarily a read learner. That's how I sort of consume, if you will. So it's super helpful. So for those of you listening, please go pick up a copy of Jeremy's book, Idea Flow, The Only Business Metric That Matters. Thank you so much for being on with us today. How can people keep in touch with you, since all of us aren't lucky enough to go to Stanford? How can people continue to learn?
We try to make it easy. I mean, certainly LinkedIn, Twitter, I'm just Jeremy Utley on LinkedIn and Twitter. And then a lot of my latest, I've been doing a lot of research around AI and its impact on teams. And this site there is called howtofixit.ai, howtofixit.ai. And then I have an AI podcast actually called beyondtheprompt.ai, which examines kind of organizational explorations of AI applications. So there's, which is to say, there's lots of places folks can track me down. I love hearing stories from people. So if you have stories about how this stuff works in your life, I'm all ears.
Awesome. Well, again, thank you so much. I am your host, Tiffany Bova. Thank you for listening in to this episode of What's Next. Don't forget to tell your friends, subscribe, leave a review, and I'll look forward to you joining us again next time. Have a great rest of your day.